Hello, everybody. Today is Friday, October 15th. I'm Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant and taking a look at the pictures. The main picture on the front page of the Times is from Beirut, Lebanon, and it's a picture of some fighters. There's five of them kneeling near a car, and it says in the caption, "Fighters supporting two Shiite Muslim parties taking their positions during sectarian clashes in Beirut, Lebanon on Thursday." We're not going to have a story on that. That is the main picture. There is one other picture on the front page of the Times. Workers at John Deere Walk rejected a contract proposal, and it said some 10,000 employees went on strike. Again, we're not going to have that story, but a picture of a gentleman with signs is on strike, and in the background you can see other signs, UAW on strike, and most of them are the same sign saying UAW on strike. Going over to the Hartford Courant, we have a picture of, at the time it was Vice President Biden, but now of course President, and in 2018 he endorsed Ned Lamont at a Hartford rally. The picture of him standing at the lectern. He's here in Hartford. He is pointing out to the audience, smiling smile on his face. Governor Lamont, or Governor-to-be Lamont, standing to his right. To his left was Representative Johanna Hayes. And the caption says, "On Friday, he will return to Connecticut for a second time since becoming president." So we're going to have that story. That'll probably be my first story from the New York, from the Hartford Courant. So we're going to start with the New York Times. First story, after a brutal summer surge driven by the highly contagious Delta variant, the coronavirus is again in retreat. The United States is recording roughly 90,000 new infections a day, down more than 40% since August. Hospitalizations and deaths are falling too. The crisis is not over everywhere. The situation in Alaska is particularly dire, but nationally the trend is clear and hopes are rising that the worst is finally behind us. Again, over the last 2 years, the pandemic has crashed over the country in waves, inundating hospitals and then receding, only to return after Americans let their guard down. It is difficult to tease apart the reasons that the virus ebbs and flows in this way, and harder still to predict the future. But as winter looms, there are real reasons for optimism. Nearly 70% of adults are fully vaccinated, and many children under 12 are likely to be eligible for their shots in a matter of weeks. Federal regulators could soon authorize the first antiviral pill for COVID-19. We are definitely, without a doubt, hands-on in a better place this year than we were last year, said Dr. Nahid Badilia, director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy and Research at Boston University. But the pandemic is not over yet, scientists cautioned. Nearly 2,000 Americans are still dying every day, and another winter surge is plausible, given how many Americans remain unvaccinated and how much remains unknown. It is too soon to abandon basic precautions, they said. We've done this again and again where we let the foot off the pedal too early, Dr. Badilia said. It behooves us to be more cautious, as we're trying to get to the finish line. When the first wave of cases hit the United States in early 2020, there was no COVID vaccine and essentially no one was immune to the virus. The only way to flatten the proverbial curve was to change individual behavior. And that is what the first round of stay-at-home orders, business closures, mask mandates, and bans on large gatherings aim to do. There is still debate over which of these measures were most effective, but numerous studies suggest that collectively they made a difference, keeping people at home and curbing the growth of case numbers. These policies, combined with voluntary social distancing, most likely helped bring the early surges to an end, researchers said. And then the measures would be lifted, but maybe memories would fade, said Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. Eventually, cases would rise again and similar patterns would play out. Businesses and local governments would re-implement restrictions, while people who had been gunned to venture out into the world again would hunker down and mask up. During last winter's surge, for instance, the percentage of Americans who reported going to bars or restaurants or attending large events declined, according to the U.S. COVID-19 Trends and Impact Survey, which has surveyed an average of 44,000 Facebook users daily since April 2020. The curve is shaped by public awareness, Dr. Nuzzo said. We're sort of lurching between crisis and complacency. Delta arrived during a period of deep pandemic fatigue and at a moment when many vaccinated Americans felt as if they could finally relax. Data suggests that the new variant prompted less profound behavioral change than previous waves. In mid-July, just 23% of Americans said they always wore a mask in public, the lowest percentage since March of 2020, according to the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, which compiles data from several sources. By August 31st, the peak of the Delta wave, that figure had risen to 41%, although it remained far below the 77% of people who reported wearing masks during the winter surge. If you just look around, people are much more living a normal life or a pre-COVID life, said Dr. Christopher Murray, director of the Institute. Still, even modest changes in behavior can help slow transmission, especially in combination, and Delta prompted changes at both the individual and organizational levels. Schools adopted new precautions, companies postponed reopenings, and organizations canceled events, giving the virus fewer opportunities to spread. Meanwhile, more temperate autumn weather arrived, making it possible for Americans in many regions of the country to socialize outside where the virus is less likely to spread. We're in a shoulder season when it's cooler in the south than it is in the middle of the summer, and it's warmer in the north than it is in the middle of the winter, said David O'Connor, a virologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Indeed, many of the current virus hotspots are in the northernmost parts of the country, from Alaska to Minnesota, where even cooler temperatures may be sending people back inside. And we're going to go over to the current now. And we have the story about President Biden's visit. Governor Ned Lamont's early and unwavering support of Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential race appears to be paying off, with the president arriving in Connecticut on Friday for the second time this year. President Biden will arrive on Air Force One and then visit a Hartford Child Care Center before heading to Yukon for the dedication of the Dodd Center for Human Rights. The Biden administration has taken notice of how Connecticut has continued to put families first. Our state has made historic investments in early childhood education to provide support for families in unprecedented ways, said Max Rice, a Lamont spokesman. What we're doing in Connecticut is what the president is looking to do at the national level, and we're proud to serve as a model. Biden also visited Connecticut in May when he delivered the commencement address at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. The president, vice president, first lady, secretary of education, Commerce Secretary and Labor Secretary have all made visits to Connecticut since Biden took office in January. "We've got a friend in the White House," Lamont said after Biden beat Donald Trump in November. "That's a big deal." Lamont's former Commissioner of Education, Mikel Gardona, was tapped by Biden to run the Federal Department of Education. Former Senator Chris Dodd also remains a close associate of the president. For Connecticut, the Biden visits highlight the impact of about $300 million in federal money for child care programs since the pandemic began. Connecticut's relatively quick distribution of this funding has been a model for other states. "This funding really did save child care. We were forecast to lose more than 40% of our supply," said Beth Bai, commissioner of the Office of Early Childhood Education. "These funds were a total life raft for programs. It really did sustain Connecticut child care supply. The massive federal funding infrastructure bills before Congress would help preserve these programs, which Bai said are critical for helping parents to return to work." Biden is expected to arrive at Bradley International Airport around noon before traveling to Hartford, where officials hope to still win funding for some of the state's costliest infrastructure proposals, a massive rebuild of the I-84 and I-91 interchange, and a radical expansion of commuter rail between New York and Boston. Biden will visit a child development center in Hartford to promote his Build Back Better agenda and the importance of investing in child care. After the visit to the child development center, Biden will then travel to stores where he will be welcomed by Dodd, his longtime colleague and close friend. I'm deeply grateful to UConn for recognizing me and my family by dedicating the Dodd Center for Human Rights, Dodd said earlier this week. I'm honored that my good friend President Biden is joining us to mark this occasion. And one other note here, motorists are asked to avoid parts of Hartford in the greater Broad Street area Friday when the president's motorcade and visit shuts down some streets. And we're going to go back to the front page of the current for this story from Washington. A congressional committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol moved aggressively against close Trump advisor Steve Bannon on Thursday, swiftly scheduling a vote to recommend criminal contempt charges against the former White House aide after he defied a subpoena. The chairman of the special committee, Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, said the panel will vote Tuesday to recommend charges against Bannon, an advisor to Donald Trump for years, who was in touch with the president ahead of the most serious assault on Congress in two centuries. The select committee will not tolerate defiance of our subpoenas, Thompson said in a statement. Bannon, he said, is hiding behind the former president's insufficient blanket and vague statements regarding privileges he has purported to invoke. We reject his position entirely. If approved by the Democratic Majority Committee, the recommendation of criminal charges would go to the full House. Approval there would send them to the Justice Department, which has final say on prosecution. The showdown with Bannon is one facet of a broad and escalating congressional inquiry with 19 subpoenas issued so far and thousands of pages of documents flowing to the committee and its staff. Challenging Bannon's defiance is a crucial step for the panel, whose members are vowing to restore the force of congressional subpoenas after they were routinely flouted under Trump. The committee had scheduled a Thursday deposition with Bannon, but his lawyer said that Trump had directed him not to comply, citing information that was potentially protected by executive privileges afforded to a president. Bannon, who was not a White House staffer on January 6th, also failed to provide documents to the panel by a deadline last week. Still, the committee could end up stymied again after years of Trump administration officials refusing to cooperate with Congress. The longtime Trump advisor similarly defied a subpoena during a GOP-led investigation into Trump's Russia ties in 2018, but the House did not move to hold him in contempt. And we have another story that is on the front page of The Current. And this is the daily coronavirus update. Connecticut is currently the safest state in the country based on COVID-19 metrics, according to an analysis published Tuesday by the personal finance website Wallet Hub. The Wallet Hub study, based on vaccination rate, positivity rate, hospitalization rate, death rate, and estimated transmission rate, found Connecticut in the best shape, followed by Massachusetts, California, and Rhode Island. Wyoming, West Virginia, and Idaho were the least safe states according to the Wallet Hub methodology. I'm incredibly proud that Connecticut is the safest state during the pandemic, Governor Ned Lamont tweeted Thursday. We've worked hard to protect lives and livelihoods. As of Wednesday, Connecticut had reported the fewest COVID-19 cases per capita of any U.S. state over the past week. Even so, recent numbers reinforce that Connecticut's coronavirus threat isn't over yet. Hospitalizations have been flat or even up slightly in recent days, and the state on Thursday reported an additional 40 COVID-19 deaths over the past week. Dr. Ulysses Wu, an infectious disease specialist at Hartford HealthCare, noted the uptick in hospitalizations and the continued drumbeat of deaths as a potential warning sign. It's too early to say if that's a trend, Wu said. I don't know what it means. Now, here are the categories that they cover every day. First, positivity rate, cases and positivity rate. Connecticut on Thursday reported 908 new COVID-19 cases out of 40,775 tests for a positivity rate of 2.23%. The state's seven-day positivity rate now stands at 1.91%, up slightly from Wednesday and about flat over the past week. Connecticut has averaged 447 COVID-19 cases a day over the past week, about even with the 7 days prior. About 72.7% of cases over the past week have occurred in unvaccinated people, according to state numbers. As of Thursday, Windham County was experiencing high levels of COVID-19 transmission, as defined by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, while Hartford, New Haven, Fairfield, New London, Middlesex, and Litchfield counties were experiencing substantial transmission. Tallinn County is now listed as having only moderate transmission, meaning people there are not advised to wear masks indoors based on CDC guidance. 40 Connecticut towns and cities, mostly in Windham and New London counties, currently qualify for the state's red alert designation, which is triggered when a municipality averages 15 or more daily COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents. The next category is hospitalizations. Connecticut now has 244 patients hospitalized with COVID-19, down one from Wednesday, but still up over the previous week. Hospitalizations had declined through much of September before leveling off recently. Hospital officials say the vast majority of those hospitalized with serious COVID-19 symptoms are unvaccinated. Deaths. Connecticut on Thursday reported 40 additional coronavirus-linked deaths over the past week, bringing its total to 8,707 during the pandemic. Deaths have remained fairly level over recent weeks, ranging from 36 to 53 over any given 7-day period. The United States has now recorded 720,223 COVID-19 deaths, according to the New York Times. Finally, vaccinations. As of Thursday, 77.3% of all Connecticut residents and 88.8% of those 12 and older had received at least one COVID-19 vaccine dose, while 69.6% of all residents and 79.9% of those 12 and older were fully vaccinated, according to the CDC. Amid demand for COVID-19 booster shots, vaccine providers in Connecticut administer 61,169 vaccine doses from October 3rd to the 9th, down slightly from 1 week before, but up from the period immediately before booster shots were authorized. Booster shots are available for recipients of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine more than 6 months removed from their second dose, who are 65 or older, have health conditions that leave them vulnerable to COVID-19, or work jobs that leave them at high risk. And one more story on the front page of The Current. Behavioral health care providers, child advocates, and representatives from state agencies there say is a widespread surge in demand for urgent pediatric behavioral health care across Connecticut. Crisis, they say, is exacerbated by insufficient staffing levels. To address the crisis that has left dozens of children waiting for mental health care at Children's and other hospitals, experts say Connecticut must first increase capacity for pediatric hospital beds immediately. Secondly, raise salaries of mental health care workers, particularly in residential programs. Expand treatment of children at home. And create stronger partnerships between schools and mobile crisis teams, which could help divert children away from emergency departments. The ongoing surge is overwhelming, said Patricia Reamer, a senior vice president at Hartford Healthcare and a co-chair of the Behavioral Health Partnership Oversight Council, which met this week to address the crisis. The council advises the State Department of Children and Families, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and the Department of Social Services. I don't know how we dig our way out of this, but it is definitely a system-wide issue of, and one that is going to take some time to get through and to get out of, said Heather Gates, the president and CEO of Community Health Resources, which operates a wide range of programs for adults and children impacted by mental illness, substance abuse disorder, or trauma in Connecticut. I don't think there are any magic bullets here, because this is affecting every provider and every service type that we all operate, Gates told the council during a meeting on Wednesday. At CHR, Gates said, there's a level of acuity that is greater than what we typically experience, as well as fewer staff to meet those needs.